Greetings and welcome to the Money Program.
It's Philosophy Talk.
Tonight on the Money Program, we're going to look at money. Lots of it, on film and in the studio.
What exactly is money?
What makes money more than the paper it's printed on?
Delicate fibers stuffed into bulging wallets, nice, crisp, clean checks, pert pieces of copper coinage thrust deep into trouser pockets.
If we were living in an ideal society, would there be money?
Is it possible to live a life without money?
I ain't in this for your revolution, man. I'm not in it for you, princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money.
Are you sure money can't buy you happiness?
My wife ain't gonna make love to me because I ain't got no money, right?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
Money never sleeps, pal.
Our guest is Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho.
Show me the money.
Why money matters.
Money isn't everything, Mortimer. Oh, grow up.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey there, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This past year, it's been everything from rage to robots, from Marcus to memoir.
So head over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the Support Us button at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosophers in your life with a subscription to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Is money the root of all evil?
Or is it just a technology that makes our lives more efficient?
Should some things just not be for sale?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Quarter on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about money matters.
Well, I think that money matters too much. We'd all be better off if we did away with money.
Oh, I don't know, Ray. I mean, if we didn't have money, how could we exchange, you know, crucial goods and services among each other?
Well, we could barter. I give you some flour, you give me some olive oil.
Well, that's fine for like oil and flour, but what if I'm, I don't know, a grape grower? I only have grapes in autumn, and I can't keep them fresh all year.
Okay, Josh, then we could make a long-term agreement. You give me a bushel of grapes in the summer, and I'll write you an IOU for a bag of flour in the winter.
You know what happens when you take that system to its logical conclusion?
Yeah, socialist paradise.
No, money.
Why would you need money in a socialist paradise?
Well, people are still going to need to save for a rainy day. I mean, there might be like a grape flu that kills all my grapes.
A grape flu? You don't know anything about grapes, do you, Josh?
Fair enough. I don't. But I do know that saving is a good thing.
Saving? You mean hoarding resources so that poor people can't access them. You know, Josh, that's how capitalism got started.
Well, maybe, but even if we don't have saving, I mean, there's still going to be trade, right? I mean, I can't grow all my own food and make all my own clothes and build my own house. I mean, I don't want to have to give you a whole horse just for a cup of sugar. That's why we need money.
Oh, I see. You think that money is just a handy mechanism for the exchange of goods.
Well, yeah. What do you think it is?
Well, obviously, Josh, it's a system invented by governments so that they can tax us.
Ray, you're starting to sound like a paranoid conspiracy theorist.
No. It's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. Look, Josh, the earliest use of money is from ancient Mesopotamia, where, guess what? It was used to keep track of taxes.
Okay, that is a fun factoid. I mean, so suppose I grant that money was first invented for taxes. That's still got nothing to do with what it is today. Just because something came into being one way doesn't mean it has to stay that way forever.
Yeah, but money still is like that today. It's guaranteed by a central bank. That's what makes it money. And the federal government can just print more of it. They just created $2 trillion to bail us out from COVID-19. And I mean, thank God they did.
Wait a minute, Ray. Hang on. You just said a minute ago you don't like money. And now you're telling me you're delighted there's trillions more of it.
Well, I mean, if the government is going to create money anyway, they should at least be humane about it.
All right, so let's be clear. What exactly is your problem with money?
Well, it tricks people into thinking that things have equal value when they don't. So look, a new insulin pump costs $6,000 if you don't have insurance. And a Patty the Platypus Beanie Baby costs $6,000. Josh, do you really think those two are worth the same?
I don't. That is crazy. Patty the Platypus? I have to admit, Ray, that is bonkers. But I guess what I want to say is that not all prices are like that, right? Sometimes you really can put a dollar value on things. Like, I don't know, when you insure your property, for example.
Yeah, I just think there should be a better system.
Oh, I've got one for you. Bitcoin.
Wait, Bitcoin? You mean the thing where money is just numbers on a computer? How is that even money?
Why shouldn't it be? People used to use salt or even rocks.
Wait, seriously? Rocks?
Yes, rocks. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to tell us more about that. She files this report.
Money. What is it?
You smell that? What is that?
What?
What's that smell?
A cologne?
No.
Opportunity?
No. Money.
Okay.
I smell money.
Okay. Money on a lot of different levels is kind of arbitrary.
Scott Fitzpatrick is a professor of anthropology at the University of Oregon. He says the money we value is often determined by randomness and geography.
A lot of currencies developed out of precious objects or precious metals and things like that.
Fitzpatrick has dedicated most of his academic life to studying giant stone money. This passion started for him in the mid-90s, when he went on a research expedition to Palau, an island nation in the Pacific. He wandered along the raised limestone islands and coral reef skeletons.
And as we trekked up into the jungle in this really jagged karst terrain, the thing I was immediately struck by was this large, flat piece of limestone that was circular in shape and it had a hole through the middle of it.
Fitzpatrick noticed a path had been cleared as though people had been preparing to shuttle this giant stone disc elsewhere.
The people who had done this were pretty good engineers. They were building other kinds of structures, stone walls and pathways and things like that to help them carve and move these very large discs.
He soon learned that centuries ago, stones like this were moved over 250 miles north of the island group of Yap. People on Yap didn't have limestone. These stones weighed more than a car, and the challenge of bringing them back and carving them only made them more valuable.
The chief would take those pieces of stone money and probably keep, you know, some of those. They would then place the stone in front of a residence, let's say, and then that person would own it.
These stones are called rye, or stone money, but Fitzpatrick says it's not strictly a currency. The Yappies would trade it as a wedding gift or to celebrate a birth. It could be traded without ever moving physically. People who lived on Yap had an oral tradition of learning and remembering who the stones belonged to at any given moment.
And that's very different than what you see in other types of societies. And that's the ability of people to have that memory.
If you took a look at your wallet, you probably wouldn't remember where your nickels came from. But Fitzpatrick says, as different colonial powers vied for control of this part of the Pacific, the use of stone money in Yap waned. These days, the U.S. dollar is the official currency of Micronesia.
Today, you know, you can walk through jungles in Yap and old traditional villages and that aren't used anymore today, and you can still find pieces of stone money laying around that don't have as much importance in everyday transactions as they once did, even maybe 100 years ago.
But stone money is still an important part of culture on Yap. You can still find an image of it on the license plates on the island. And Fitzpatrick says this old currency has a lot to teach us about a new kind of money, cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, like stone money, isn't moved physically. It has value even though...
Money on a lot of different levels is kind of arbitrary.
Sting is a pyramid since time immemorial. Shit runs downhill, money goes up. It's that simple.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
That report rocked, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're thinking about money matters.
We're joined now by Graham Hubbs, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Idaho, where he's also chair of politics and philosophy. Graham, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks.
So, Graham, lots of people are interested in money for one reason or another, but you're interested from a philosophical perspective. So what first got you going in that direction? Do you have a collection of valuable rocks somewhere?
Well, I got interested when I was worried about having a collection of valuable nothings. I was on the job market in 2008 and 2009 when the financial crisis hit, and all the jobs that were available in academic philosophy seemed to wither up overnight. Not being able to fully understand what had happened around me, I became interested in economics in a way that I hadn't been beforehand. And it was didn't take very long before that interest in economics led to asking fundamental questions like, what is money and how does its existence in nature exert the kind of control over our day-to-day lives that it does? And I was off and running from there.
Yeah, Josh and I were just arguing about the nature of money earlier. So he thinks it arose spontaneously from a barter economy, and I think it was invented by governments to tax us. So Graham, who do you think is right?
Ray is right. And since Ray is right, we can stop the show. We've already solved all the questions we need to be
talking. Great. Do you have anything to
say? No. So the question that comes up immediately after asking the historical question, where I do think the weight of the evidence favors Ray's view, is how does that matter for an analysis of what money is today, the way that it functions in modern capitalist economies? I think that we would do better when we get to this point of the discussion to step back from asking about money itself conceived of as an object and instead analyze the concept of money and say, so what is the concept of money and what sorts of things fall under it? And there's pretty widespread agreement that there's four functions that money or money-like things have. That is to serve as a universal medium of exchange, so to be used to buy and sell things on the market, to be used as a means of payment, which includes discharging debts and obligations to the state, being a store of value, and that's the one that I'll come back to focus on here in a second, and then finally being a unit of account, being able to denominate prices and liabilities and that sort of thing.
Before we get off the subject of origins, aren't there cases, maybe the very first use of money was for tax reasons, but aren't there cases? I'm thinking, for example, you know, this guy R.A. Radford wrote this lovely essay in 1945 about the spontaneous emergence of a money-like system in a prisoner of war camp during World War II, where all of a sudden cigarettes stopped becoming a thing that you could just buy and sell and started becoming actual cash, right? That became the currency. So haven't there been cases where, in fact, a money-like system did evolve from barter?
Sure. So when you read the Radford paper, one of the things that's interesting is the fact that the British officers who were kind of running the prison camp had an exchange where they were accepting cigarettes at a centralized location for the various goods that were available there. So even in that particular example, if I'm remembering the paper correctly, it's not that cigarettes emerged from out of nowhere the way that maybe Adam Smith describes a gold or precious metal emerging as the universal medium of exchange. But even if that were to be the right story about what went on there, when we're analyzing the nature of money, it seems like what's going on there is that a group of people who are very familiar with money and cash transactions in a capitalist economy just make do with what they've got sitting around in order to manage their little economy within the prison. I think it's more philosophically interesting to say, how did we come up with the practice and the concept initially, given the varieties of ways that we can imagine distributing goods through a society?
So if I have a commodity that's not regulated by a central bank, but that exists in a wider money system, does it sort of inherit its moneyness from the wider system? Like, I think I'm a little puzzled still about why the cigarettes counted as money. Was it because there was a central like pseudo bank, or was it because they lived in a bigger money system?
Oh, well, let me back up. I would say that the reason that I began by enumerating functions associated with the concept of money is that I think that we do best to think about money as a family resemblance concept. There are going to be things that are more or less money-ish. So within that economy, cigarettes are money-ish to the extent that they are serving the universal medium of exchange function and they're being used to denominate prices. But presumably they're not clearing all debts and being used as means of payments the way that sovereign currency is in a state that issues its own currency. So the folks who've got a money concept are applying it, you know, sort of to meet the economic needs that they happen to have, meager as they are in the prison camp. It's just table thumping at that point for one person to insist, oh, that's definitely money, or for someone to say, no, it's not, because it's, you know, not issued by a sovereign sort of authority.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about money matters with Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho.
Is the price of something the same as its value? Should we trust the invisible hand of the market? Are there some things that shouldn't be for sale?
Money, markets, and morals. When Philosophy Talk continues. You have to come right flat out and tell you everything. Give me some money. Ray, why don't you give me some money?
No.
It was worth a shot. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about money matters with Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho.
Unfortunately, we can't take your phone calls, but we can keep the conversation going online. Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or tweet us. Our handle is @PhilTalkRadio.
So, Graham, would you say that money is a good way of measuring value?
Well, within markets, I think it may be the only way to measure value of all of the things on the market so that they're all commensurable with one another. But I think that we should presuppose that the only value that a thing has is its market value. Which is why I think it's useful for keeping track of the different functions of money again and thinking of it as a family resemblance concept. If you get seduced into thinking that money is exactly one kind of thing and has one kind of value, then its use to evaluate things would amount to evaluating it on exactly one metric. If money is multifaceted and multiform, then the varieties of values and kinds of values that it might measure might themselves be various.
Do you think that there's a concern here that money could create illusions of commensurability when in fact, like, two things just aren't comparable in value at all? Like, say, take the life of somebody who needs a life-saving medical device versus a lot of people having a pleasant commodity. Like, maybe the life is worth like infinitely more, or maybe there's just no comparison to be made there. Like, does money like distort that in some way?
I wouldn't put the onus on money per se, but again, markets and the ways in which goods move through markets and the democratizing effects of markets put everything on an even keel. When one goes back to the history of money, so one of the elements of the history Ray's already recounted is the use of money in order to denominate and collect taxes. Another ancient form of money is known as vergeld, which is the kind of money that I believe in ancient Germanic societies was used to pay off things like blood debts, where the money itself was a recognition that the thing that it was being used to pay off was something that could never be paid off. If someone kills your cousin and you demand something in return from them short of the life of another person, there's a recognition on all sides that the thing that is being taken is exactly not the same thing as the equivalence of a life. So there's an old history of money that already baked into the concept is this tension between demanding something in payment for something that could never be repaid, like the life of a family member.
That's really interesting because you often hear the line that comes originally from Georg Simmel, the sociologist, that, you know, money is just a bad thing because it reduces all qualitative differences to quantitative. But you're saying, first of all, it's not just money that potentially does that. It could be, it's just the markets, or maybe it's just a form of the markets. Maybe it's a certain kind of capitalism. And then secondly, that even within the money system, you could still recognize qualitative value. So are you ultimately an optimist? Do you think, you know, in this capitalist world we live in where money is quasi-ubiquitous, we can still live within the kind of social arrangement that we would all want to?
I am optimistic that when we go through the history of money and when we analyze the concept of money from a philosophical perspective, we can see that many of us, perhaps most of us, have been blinded by a narrow conception of money that arose, I think, near the end of the 17th century and has had a grip on our thinking over the course of the last few centuries, that once we liberate ourselves from that, we can see the power of money to do what we want it to do rather than us answer to it as if it were a virus, some sort of alien force that was controlling our lives and, you know, making us unable to get jobs when we're on the job market in 2008 and 2009.
So I'm curious about commensurability, which you mentioned, and sort of having different forms of money to pay off different kinds of debts. So it seems like one possible type of system you could have is have sort of different economies for different kinds of commodities. And we have sort of things that resemble this. So I think food stamps, which can only be used to pay for groceries, are kind of an example of like a limited money. And I was reading a paper by Posner and some collaborators that suggested vote buying. You don't want people to actually like buy votes with real money, because then rich people will buy up all the votes. But if you gave everybody the same number of voter credits and allowed them to spend them on issues they cared about, maybe that would be a good scheme. Do you think that having separate economies is a valuable way forward?
Well, I think that there are some interesting lessons to be drawn from the anthropology and sociology of money in this regard. So the anthropologist, the Bohannans, studied the TIV in Nigeria in the 50s and 60s and wrote about how they had different spheres of exchange. So there, it wasn't like different forms of money were being used for votes on the one hand as opposed to commercial goods on the other. But money itself was only used in markets, where the presupposition of going to the market is that you would be dealing with people who were effectively strangers, who would try to screw you over if they could. It's a toned down version of Hobbes's State of Nature. And so that you always had to be on guard and suspicious about what was going on in the transaction that you would have with such a person. And so you'd get haggling over the price of things. But did you never behave that way with your neighbors? When you think about what a neighborly debt is like, imagine going to your neighbor's house in the old-fashioned example of getting a cup of sugar or a little bit of butter so that you can make some cookies. You know, it would be unneighborly for your neighbor to then say like, okay, I want 7 cents in return for that quarter ounce of butter that I gave you or whatever. No, instead, the nice thing to do is to bring him some cookies when you're done. And what they noticed was that in those kinds of exchanges, people were always a little bit into debt to one another. You'd always bring back a few too many or a few too few cookies so as to maintain the social structure within your neighborly interactions. So there you get two different spheres of activity. In the neighborly arrangement, you don't really have money, but you do have some sort of loose debt tracking going on. But you need to be really precise when you deal with strangers that you can't trust in that way. So I think that there's a lot of lessons to be taken from that. Could you formalize that? I don't know. I'm not entirely sure about that. But being aware of those different kinds of debt relations is helpful for us thinking about how we can use money and the kinds of social relations that we bear to one another.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about money matters with Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho. So, Graham, I love your optimism, and I think I'm persuadable. But before you get me completely on your side, I want to try out a couple of, you know, possible worries, additional worries about money. One is something that Ray mentioned earlier about hoarding. Right? Money is great because it allows us to save. But the flip side of that is people can hoard money. There can be this creation of hereditary inequality, which is something that Thomas Piketty has talked about. And another is a kind of perverse incentive, right? That once you have money, people can start wanting money as their ultimate goal, right? It's not just a means to an end so that you can get more Beanie Babies or whatever it is that you want, but you can, you know, set as your goal a kind of endless accumulation of money, as Marx thought. Even Aristotle had to worry about this. So how do we push the system more in the direction that you were just talking about, this wonderful sort of positive system where people deliberately, you know, people treat their neighbors kindly and they don't just, you know, quibble over 7 cents and avoid these negative consequences?
Right. Well, this is where I think it is relevant to go back to the difference between the theory of money, Josh, that I think that you were outlining at the beginning, which is the market theory of money, that money spontaneously emerges out of market transactions, and the cardalist view that Ray was articulating. One of the things that the cardalist view, at least as it's embraced by modern monetary theory today, recognizes is the capacity of currency created by sovereign governments to be managed as just technical instruments of the government. So worries about accumulation, if you think about money primarily as a legal tool in order to organize labor amongst the citizens of a state, then it's a tool that can be brought under the power of law. So you deal with problems of accumulation by levying inheritance taxes. That's one way at least to take care of or to mitigate some of the effects of transgenerational wealth accumulation. So thinking about it from the cardalist perspective, money, again, is not this alien quasi-biological force out there that's running rampant. It's simply a tool of law, and laws can be made in order to mitigate its negative effects. In terms of it being an object of accumulation, there's a good argument to be made that that's just what capitalism requires. And so if you wanted to somehow legislate out taking money as an object in and of itself to be accumulated, and you're right, Aristotle worried about this, and Marx thought that there was deep insight there, that's going to be, I think, the end of capitalism. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not weighing in on that one right here. But I think that there's a tight connection there that maybe is what you're signaling.
Yeah. So you've emphasized the role of the state a couple of times, which I think is a very cardalist idea. And I'm kind of curious about the role of corporations in making money sort of mean what it does and function the way it does. So it seems like the entities that wield a lot of economic power in our lives are things like Google or Amazon, which have like entire production chains that they control and like many, many deployed workers. Are they entities that we should be looking at changing internally, like just abolishing? Like, how should we even think about those entities and their relation to money?
Right. Well, let me back up and say that another kind of corporate entity that needs mention in this discussion is banks. Mm-hmm. Bank deposits end up creating, you know, I think over 90% of the money that actually gets used in the economy today. So they are private banks or institutions that need to be mentioned in terms of the nature of money and the creation of money and you know, the regulatory framework that we would want to bring out in order to make money serve the ends of the population to the best extent possible. But back to the Amazons and the Googles of the world, I mean, it seems to me like the questions to be raising about them have been raised for years now, which is, are they monopolies? And in as much as they're monopolies, are they harmful even under capitalism, precisely because of the monopolistic effects that they're able to exert? So I would think that that's the right way to approach the potential problems of companies those sides, is to revisit old concerns about problems of monopoly and capitalism, and not think that treating them immediately with considerations of money is the thing to be done.
Let me see if I get this straight. Am I right in thinking that your view is, if we have the proper understanding of money, which is that ultimately it's a tool that a state can use, and like many other tools, it's sort of value neutral, depends how it's used. And, you know, if we can set the state up right, well, we can actually get money to do good things for us. So first of all, is that right? And secondly, what kinds of good things?
I like that idea a lot, that once we think about money as a tool, it in of itself becomes value neutral. I mean, I guess I'm still Aristotelian about this. It does have a telos. And so baked into that telos is going to be some mode of valuation, but it's far more value neutral than we might otherwise think. How do we put money to good use? Well, we make sure that there is enough of it to keep people employed, to keep people being able to obtain the things that they need in order to live, and to keep people, you know, living the Aristotelian distinction, not merely for the sake of mere life, but for the sake of good life. Well-managed monetary regimes should enable us to live that way. And so if we're in a time of recession, heading into depression, and people are having a hard time getting the goods that they need, even just for the ends of mere life, making sure that they have access to the money and credit they need in order to go on living until the economy can recover, say from a massive virus that's made millions upon millions of people unemployed. That's something that it's within the power of the state to do in order to keep us all living as well as we possibly can under strange conditions.
So is the concrete proposal that I should take out of this, like, an economic stimulus is really important because it's a thing that the government can do and that can help people sort of get by during a crisis time. Is that right?
Precisely.
And how does that work? I mean, this is something I've never understood. How can the government keep printing money? And some people say there's got to be a limit to how much money the government can print. And other people seem to think, well, at least we haven't reached it yet. What's your view on that?
Right. So I think that the temptation to think that there is a limit comes from analogizing the government to a household or to an individual or maybe even to a corporation, which is still a private entity. In all of those instances, if you want to obtain goods or services or pay for labor or whatever, you need to go out and get some money in order to obtain for the things or pay for the things that you want. You can do so legally by going out and working. You do so illegally by going out and stealing a bunch of money. But one way or the other, you have to go somewhere else to get the thing that you need in order to pay for what you want. And that is precisely what the government doesn't have to do. The government can just create money as it needs in order to do what it wants. So that might be putting people to work, as the model there would be the works programs during the in the aftermath of the Great Depression. We see that on being proposed through a Green New Deal, which could be financed in the mode of the government just creating more money. Note also that a sovereign that creates its own currency is able to pay any of its debts in that currency, because that's all that its debts are promises to pay in the very currency that it has the capacity to create. So an analogy that modern monetary theorists use to show the silliness of talking about the government running out of money: if you go bowling, it doesn't make any sense to talk about the bowling alley running out of points. There's as many points as there need to be, depending upon the number of pins that get knocked down. Similarly, the government is not limited extrinsically in a metaphysical way. Now, they might be limited legally. If the United States were still on the gold standard, then there would be exchangeability rates that would determine the amount of currency that it could issue. But since it went off of the gold standard in the 1970s, it's been subject to no such legal restrictions. And even then, those weren't, take our law hat off and put our philosopher's hat on, not genuine metaphysical restrictions that were placed on the amount of currency that could be produced.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about money matters with Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho.
Is money more trouble than it's worth? Can we change it to reap more of its benefits? Or would we be better off without money altogether?
The future of money, when Philosophy Talk continues. Cash rules everything for now, but maybe it's time for a new regime. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Graham Hubbs from the University of Idaho, and we're thinking about money matters.
So Graham, I'm very impressed, not just with your analyses of what money is, but also your thoughts about what money could be. So we're going to appoint you czar of money here today. We're going to give you total power to solve all of the problems we were talking about earlier, the Aristotle problem, Marx's worry, Georg Simmel's worry. What's the first thing you're going to do with these powers?
Right. I'm going to show my philosophical stripes here, I think. And the first thing I'm going to do is implement an education campaign beginning
Excellent.
Probably in middle school, but certainly by high school, to include the study of economics, of macroeconomics, and the history and anthropology and philosophical analysis of money. So that it's just a part of what people are brought up thinking about hard. The reason that I think that that's so important is, I think I said this earlier, since I'd lay the blame at the foot of the great John Locke, in the late 17th century, there has been this tendency, both on the part of lay folks and on the part of many professional economists, to assume that for money to be valuable, it would have to be valuable in the way that a commodity is valuable, because you know, commodities are where value lie, and markets are the way that we distribute value amongst a population. And once you start thinking of down that road, and you get trapped into conceiving of money itself as a commodity, it's a very special commodity, how does it have the power that it does, blinding yourself entirely to this entire alternative way of thinking about money, the Carterist way. And it can then lead to raising the kinds of questions that we were just talking about. Well, if the government just creates an endless amount of money, isn't it going to create deficits that it can never pay off? Those questions presuppose an account of money that, you know, if we could shake off the thinking about money originally as if it were a commodity, then we would free ourselves to be able to think more creatively about it. I'm reminded of the way that Anscombe talks in her paper on modern moral philosophy, and says that we need to shake off the thinking about morality in terms of the moral ought, because that concept ought only makes sense within the context of there being a divine legislature. And even though she herself was Catholic, she thought most people don't believe in a divine legislature anymore. And so the very idea that we ought to do things as if a law was handed down from on high doesn't make any sense. Similarly, I think if we can shake ourselves free of gold standard thinking, we might open up ourselves to the possibility of wider ways of using money to take care of ourselves.
So suppose I get educated in the new education system. I'm wondering how will this change my life? So like one way it might change my life is that I might sort of conduct my own private life differently and sort of have different ideas about how to spend my money. And I guess another way is that I might sort of vote for different politicians and consider different social and economic policies viable. So what would you like to see changing in response to a more educated population?
Well, one of the things that you would see is that the question raised by politicians, in particular federal politicians in Washington, D.C., how are we going to pay for that, would never be taken seriously anymore. It wouldn't be a concern, because the answer to how are we going to pay for that would be, we will just create the money that we need to pay for that. Readjusting the political discourse so that does not become an artificial limit on what we have the capacity to do as a nation. I speak here as a citizen of the United States, but this line of thought would apply to any nation that is issues its own sovereign currency. I think would reshape the political debate in a way that would help the lives of many, many people who don't get access to, you know, often things that they need for mere life, and certainly things that they need for good life, due to artificial constraints imposed by thinking that the government is subject to the same kind of budgetary pressures that you and I are.
I have a question about how are we going to pay for that. I don't want to know how we're going to pay for that, but I want to know like whether we should be paying for all of the things that we currently pay for as private citizens. So right now, my employer pays for my health care. If I did not have an employer that did that, I would be paying sort of out of pocket for my health insurance. Right now, I pay for a place to live, and I pay my landlord for a place to live. And if I wanted to buy a house, I would pay for that, and then I would pay property taxes. How much of that stuff should the government be providing? How much of it should be sort of open to markets?
I guess my initial reaction to that question is to say that the part of the ebb and flow of democracy is trying things out and seeing what works and what doesn't work. I don't have a prescriptive view as a all-out capitalist or an all-out socialist or an all-out Marxist about what the state should or shouldn't be supplying. I guess what I would say on this show, focused on the question of the nature of money, is that the way to answer those questions is to talk about what people need, talk about what the government can supply well, talk about what the market can supply well, but never allow the question, how are we going to pay for it, to enter into those decision makings. That's again, because money is just a tool, it's the thing that we'll drag in at the end to figure out how best to, if we think that the state should be giving everybody a place to live, then how to use money and the power of taxation and so forth in order to supply that. The re-education campaign that I would be advocating for as czar of money would, I guess, put money in its place and recognize the question of how to pay for things as a secondary concern, so that we could go on, Ray, and maybe take your social theory class that would then answer these questions more directly about which of these things is should we prioritize as things to be delivered by the state.
That's a nice thought, because I had a little worry, you know, is I love your idea. I mean, hey, teaching is great. But, you know, you see people having some views that I think are a little disturbing about the market, right? Where, I mean, so for example, you know, we're currently living in a time of lockdown thanks to the coronavirus outbreak. And you have some people saying, you know, maybe we'd just be better off if we gave it to everybody, right? On the grounds that it's hurting the markets. And well, you know, if some number of people need to die, maybe that's a necessary evil to keep the Dow Jones Industrial Average up. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, the movie Metropolis, where you're feeding human beings into the machine. So how do you, is it enough to teach people what money is in order to change their views of the market?
I don't think so. I think that studying the ethics of our social existence under capitalism is going to be multifaceted. And in the course of teaching people these things in a democracy, and especially in a democracy that's coupled with capitalism, you're going to get a variety of views. I don't think that you would ever, short of some sort of philosophical totalitarianism, which is incompatible with our conception of liberal democracy, that you're going to be able to extinguish some of those views about give people the disease so that, you know, the markets can thrive or something like that, you know, where the monster, all of the various monsters that are not humans are the ones that need to survive, and we need to answer to their whims. I mean, I don't know. I don't always find myself in agreement with Mill on the value of free speech. And I rather don't like the metaphor of the marketplace of ideas, because that means the idea that, you know, fetches the most popular opinion is the one that wins, because that's how markets work. Nevertheless, I think that the sentiment that Mill's trying to express there about let all ideas out and then let the best ones, where the best ones are judged by norms of reason, succeed, you know, those ideas are still going to be around, even if the czar of money has his way and is teaching cartelism to seventh graders.
I mean, this actually makes me wonder about the interaction between money and the spread of ideas, which I think, like, we see in a lot of domains. So political campaign finance, the more money you have, the more chance you have to get your political ideas out. Also sort of net neutrality, which I think is probably not going to happen at this point. But the idea that, like, maybe we should just democratize anybody's information, ability to put information out on the internet and make it sort of have, in some sense, the same like difficulty or cost, no matter who you are. Like, how do I sort of free ideas from the grasp of money and make sure that those two things aren't getting conflated?
Right. Great. So let's go to the issue of Citizens United and money as campaign speech. You know, on the face of it, it's absurd to say that money is speech. In a vacuum, the metaphysics of those two things are so wildly different from one another, it would make one wonder how could anybody equate the two. I think that thinking about money as the power in the market and in the private sphere to do what one wants, and one of the things that one could do if one so wanted would be to express a certain set of ideas and maybe even a certain set of political ideas, can all be traced back to thinking about money primarily in its market function and as it being a universal medium of exchange to purchase whatever one wants there. If instead one thinks of money primarily as a bureaucratic tool for the state to manage the state's activities, if we see that it is damaging to democracy to allow certain voices to have outsized weight over others because of the economic power behind those ideas, because of the vested interest that those ideas prop up, we can then use money, thinking about it from the cartelist point of view, as a way to make sure that the flow of ideas is democratized. And so that might be good old-fashioned campaign finance reform. So I think that when we, again, free ourselves from the idea that money is first and foremost something that is used to purchase goods and services in a market, and think about it instead as a tool that we can use to make our democracy function better, then there shouldn't be, you know, A, you shouldn't be tempted into thinking that money is speech, but B, you should think, how can we use money so as best to generate, realize, and sustain the common will of the people rather than protect the limited interest of a few?
Graham, we're coming towards the end of our time, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you at all about Bitcoin. So you got 30 seconds for us on cryptocurrency?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my answer on Bitcoin, maybe it'll loop us back to where we started. Let's not think about money as if it were a natural kind. Money is a cluster concept, a family concept. There are money-ish things. Bitcoin is a money-ish thing. It's something that is used to denominate prices in Bitcoin markets, and it's used to exchange for goods in that market. It's obviously not a sovereign currency by design, and so it can't be used to settle payments in the way that sovereign currencies are.
Well, Graham, this has been an enriching conversation. And I've got to say, I hope you're right. I hope we do get your education program and we can turn this thing around. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you all. This was delightful. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak on the show.
Our guest has been Graham Hubbs, professor of philosophy at the University of Idaho, where he's also chair of politics and philosophy. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
You know, I like having money, but I think I like better having a functioning society. And I see how different ways of regulating money can cause society to function better or worse. And I think I'd be quite happy with less money if it meant a sort of more functional system overall.
Yeah, I agree. I'm still trying to weigh up on the basis of what Graham was saying. What's really the culprit here? Is it money or is it trade? Is it trade or is it capitalism? Is it capitalism or is it the rapacious capitalism we currently
These
have?
These things are linked.
You know, Scandinavia?
Yeah.
Okay. So if they're linked, then yes, we have to go back to the root and start again. But this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now, if time is money, here's a guy that can save you millions. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, money is not a simple thing. It represents a system where one thing stands for another thing that may not even exist. Money is a cultural whim, codified, signified, and put to work. It's like rain. It can quench thirst, drown you, flood, evaporate, of course, artificial rain, artificial snow that is melted, then treated with economic theory so it's safe to drink. That might be true. Even people who know what money is don't know. Take Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin. Recently, spearheading his massive package of public dimes into a pandemic-stricken America, he stated, quote, "I think the entire package provides an economic relief overall for about 10 weeks," unquote. Included in that package was a payout for individuals, giving rise to Twitter opinions that Mnuchin thinks $1,200 can keep you going for 10 weeks. Sure, if you live with your mom and don't eat. Mnuchin was seen as not knowing the value of a dollar, and if the Secretary of the Treasury doesn't, who does? Well, there's Kelly Loeffler, junior senator from Georgia, appointed after the elected senator resigned. She's under consideration to be on President Trump's economic council to determine how to get the nation running again after we clear the street of gun-toting protesters. I mean, come on, don't they have a home to go to? Anyway, after a private congressional briefing on the coronavirus last January, Loeffler sold off some stock to Twitter America. This looked like insider trading. Senator Loeffler went to Tucker Carlson to say she hadn't known about it. Her portfolio managers handle her trades. Well, then. Before she was a senator, her MBA got her gigs at Citibank and more, leading to the Intercontinental Exchange, which deals with the major arcana of metaphysical capitalism, futures, derivatives, credit default swaps. As I see it, it's kind of a dollar store for people with $1 billion. Anyway, she married the CEO and now possesses, to her surprise perhaps, a 15,000-square-foot estate out of Atlanta. I bring this up to point out that this wizard of finance says she does not know how her own money is spent. That's all done by elves and algorithms and the wisdom of the marketplace. On Fox News, she claimed that she's being attacked for her success. Defending free enterprise is why she came to Washington to live on the public dime. So the attacks on her are ipso facto socialist. Wondering if she might have gained the system is proof. It's how socialism is identified now. Meanwhile, protesters in the street are protesting governors for being communist. which I guess means they favor lockdowns and social distancing, which are communist definitions now. I notice when they're interviewed, protesters don't complain about jobs. No, they can't get their hair done or buy a board at Home Depot or have a basketball barbecue in the park or go to the lake. It's a stunted fantasy of freedom and independent wealth and health and tons of leisure time and willing to risk the virus to have it. At least not minding if you get it, you communist. When a public dime is given by Mnuchin or anybody, when does it stop being a public dime? Do you have to launder it like cocaine money? Is that why we have casinos? Your own public dime, your tax refund, is it really yours? This brings up issues of fungibility, which means, as I understand it, that all dimes are the same. When I worked at a bar years ago, there were quarters in the till marked with red nail polish to feed the jukebox. When the jukebox man came round, he gave them back to the bar. They were not fungible. They were medium of exchange good in one market only, and when you spent one, you got one back. Socialism? You tell me. Once upon a time, a guy could exchange a cow for magic beans, get a beanstalk up to a castle in the sky with a giant singing harp, pots of gold. I mean, come on. Who needs money managers when you have a magic harp that can sing giants to sleep? If that's socialism, well, so be it. I want to be a socialist. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Sorry. But I love money. All money. I've always wanted money to handle, to touch.